Helicopter pilot Ian McConnell, along with the rest of his air station crew, was summoned at 4 a.m. on the morning of August 30th, 2005, to the Coast Guard Aviation Training Center in Mobile, Alabama. The center soon became one of the first bases of operation for Hurricane Katrina relief. McConnell's crew got right to work, airlifting stranded people from their rooftops, out of windows, delivering them to the Superdome. To their frustration, however, they were only able to help a relatively few amount of people. In an interview, McConnell shared why. Often, the people they attempted to rescue refused the rescue, refused to be picked up. They always warned them about the danger, but they still refused. He felt frustrated and angry since they had used up precious time and fuel and resources, had put themselves at risk during each rescue attempt. He said, "I felt like they were ungrateful, but in truth, they did not know how desperate their situation was." The Bible warns people about God's coming judgment, but people just ignore the warnings. We try to tell people about Christ. You have, I'm sure. And they reject the help. The truth is that people do not know how desperate their situation is. The book of Revelation is one big, powerful warning, but people disregard the warning. They will tell us that they do not need the salvation we offer them. I'm getting along just fine. People will look for any excuse not to pay attention to the very important message of this book. There is a judgment coming. Christ's justice provokes his judgment. Beginning in Revelation chapter 6, we see Christ's wrath being poured out on this world of sin. That's not a message people want to hear. It's not popular. They want to believe that life will keep getting better and better. People reject this warning about the end of the world, but they do not understand how desperate their situation really is. Revelation 6 begins with the famous four horsemen of the apocalypse. The imagery has frequently entered into the mainstream of American literature, popular thinking. It's not these four horsemen, but they made it on a postage stamp anyway. The legendary four horsemen of Notre Dame. We looked last week at the first of these horsemen, the rider on the white horse, Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. And we learned that that pictures the religious movement claiming to follow Christ and promote global peace. Now we come to the next in this series of visionary experiences, the red horse rider in Revelation 6, verses 3 and 4. Christ initiates worldwide war. Christ initiates worldwide war. Now, if that doesn't fit your picture of Christ, then you need to study the scriptures more. For he is also a God of judgment. Verse 3. "And when he broke," he is Christ, "when he," Christ, "broke the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, 'Come.' And another, a red horse, went out, and to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, out of the earth, and that men should slay one another, and a great sword was given to him." The breaking of the seals opens the wrath of God to be poured out on this world, and Christ is the one who opens these seals. And these acts are done then by agents at the very command of Christ himself. The living beings that surround the throne command these horses with their riders to come and do what they are told to do. The expression, "it was given to him," clearly indicates that Christ is in control of these actions. He gives the rider the authority to carry these actions out. So each seal is an act of Christ's wrath in judgment being carried out on this world of sin. He may use human agents to do it, but it is still the wrath of the Lamb being explained in Revelation chapter 6. Now, last Sunday, we tied the prophecy to the words of the prophet Daniel, written 500 years before Christ. Daniel had predicted that 70 sevens were necessary. That's literally what it says. 70 weeks of years or 70 sevens were necessary to finish the transgression and to make an end of sin. The disciples asked Jesus near the end of his life on earth, "What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus used the events of Daniel the prophet to frame his answer in Matthew 24. And he divided this final seven, this final seven-year period, into two segments. There was the beginning of birth pangs and then the great tribulation. And he went on to tell us first about the beginning of birth pangs. The white horse in Revelation 6 corresponds to the prediction of counterfeit Christs in Matthew 24, verse 5. The false Christ will promote global peace for a time. Then Christ commissions the red horse rider in verses 3 and 4 of Revelation 6. The red horse and rider will be given the power to take away this peace that the white horse rider set up in the world, so that men begin to slaughter one another. So he takes away the peace, and war erupts. What did Jesus say would happen 65 years before John wrote these words? Jesus predicted, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frustrated, for those things must take place. But that is not the end." And a moment later, Jesus added that these horrific wars were but the beginning of birth pangs, Matthew 24, 8. So war, genocide, ethnic cleansing are human behaviors that have a spiritual motivation. There are spiritual forces at work that bring about these horrible acts of human depravity. These are not just economic or political problems. They are spiritual problems. And they reveal the dark forces that are at work in our world. Now, we certainly have seen this evil in history and seen it in our day and in modern times. Adolf Hitler, World War II come to mind as prime examples of evil at work in this world. But as we near the end of this age, Jesus said, we will see it come to a head as the spiritual forces at work on earth will carry out evil in all of its fullness as man has never seen before. And all of this begins with Christ breaking the seal. So Christ initiates this time of worldwide war. God uses men to begin his judgment of men. But Jesus said, this is not yet the end. And he called it the beginning of birth pangs in Matthew 24. All right, second principle this morning. World war produces global famine. Verse 5. And when Christ broke the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard, as it were, a voice in the center of the four living creatures say, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." So Christ opens the third seal, and the third living being commands the third horseman to come to the throne of heaven in this vision. This horse and rider are black, and the rider has a set of scales in his hand for weighing out commercial transactions. And then John hears a voice speaking, and the voice comes from the middle of the four living beings. What do we know from our study of the throne room is in the middle of the four living beings back in the previous chapter. It is the throne of God. God the Father and Christ Himself, the Son, occupy that throne in the middle of the four living beings. So Christ's voice is crying out these words then. God's voice is crying out these words that are said here. A quart of wheat for a denarius, three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. That is God's voice speaking there. He is administering then the famine as an act of His judgment. So there will be a global famine. A quart of wheat was about what it took to feed one person per day in the ancient world. And three quarts of barley was about what it took to feed a small family per day. Barley had much less nutritional value than wheat and was normally fed to animals. A denarius was equivalent to a full day's wage. So essentially what God is saying is, man will work one day for one day's food in this famine that takes place in the world. And then Christ said that humans should be careful not to damage the wine and the oil, for these items were necessary for their lives in this world. Take care of them in a time of famine. In fact, Domitian, just before John wrote these words, there had been a great famine in the Roman Empire, and he had tried to cut down all of the olive groves in Asia Minor to put up wheat fields, and the people were very upset by this. And so this whole imagery is very fresh in their minds as these churches, as these Christians hear this account. See, in a world without much drinking water, wine was important for health, and oil was necessary for almost any kind of cooking in the ancient world. Now, we know from history that when war takes over a country, famine is soon to follow. We see in Africa today, in such war-torn situations as Darfur, Ethiopia, Sudan, many others, in these war-torn countries, how famine invades the lives of everyone. Now, imagine the horror of worldwide war and the resulting devastation to the crops will be immense. Jesus predicted back in Matthew 24, verse 7, that nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be earthquakes and famines. So Christ initiates the worldwide war, and world war produces global famine. God is using these horrible events to judge this world. And at the same time, these are warnings that it's getting worse, not better. Listen to God. He's talking in the midst of all of this evil, trying to get men and women to listen. Your situation is getting desperate. Thirdly, global famine brings catastrophic death. Verse 7. And when he broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come." And I looked, and behold, an ashen horse, or a pale horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following with him. And authority was given to them over a fourth of the earth, to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. The fourth horse is described as a pale horse. The word literally means greenish yellow in color. Or it was often used to describe the pallor of a corpse. It's the color of death. And indeed, the rider is called Death. The horse and rider have a trailer, though. They have someone coming behind them. There was a form following behind the horse and rider. John calls this form Hades. hell. Hades was actually a reference to the grave or the underworld. So coming along behind this rider on his horse was Hades, personified as one who catches up all who are dying in his horrible grasp. Talk about a nightmare. John's having one doozy of a nightmare here. You know, just stop for a moment, because we get caught up in all of the analysis. But the vision is intended to horrify us. It is intended to make us feel the horror of what is coming upon this earth. That's why it is being given to John in this manner. Men and women will not be able to escape the specter of death, followed by the grave swallowing people up at the end of this age. Once again, notice that this horse and rider are ordered to come into the throne room by the final living being, and that the authority to kill is a delegated authority. Who alone has the authority over life and death? God. God delegates this authority to death here. Death is in God's hands ultimately. But he delegates that authority to do this evil to this evil force at work in this world. Yet God places limits on death, doesn't he? Even at this juncture of human history. Death, he says, is allowed to kill a fourth of the world's population. There's a limit. Horrific enough, but it's still limited by God. Well, according to the population clock, as of yesterday afternoon, February 24, 2007, I forgot to write down the time, there were 6,578,449,358 people on planet Earth. A quarter of that population would be 1,644,612,339 people. Over 1.5 billion people will die in this horrible purge, in a very short period of time. Folks, that is more people dying in that short time period than have died in all the wars on earth for the past 200 years. This is horrible. Obviously, nothing like this has happened yet in the history of earth. So it's yet future to us. 1.5 billion people will die by war, famine, pestilence, wild beasts. The word pestilence, by the way, is the same word that is translated death in the previous verse. Pestilence is the name of the rider on the black horse. The word means literally a plague or disease. We've certainly had epidemics of plagues in human history, the bubonic plague, for example, disease. So disease will be a major player bringing horrific death to this world. Now, Jesus predicted that there would be plagues and famines in various places on earth as part of the beginning of birth pangs for the end of the age. Matthew 24, he says it, it's even clearer in Luke 21, verse 11. So all of these four seals, I think, will take place prior to the abomination of desolation that Daniel had predicted 500 years before Christ, and Christ predicts in Matthew 24, verse 15. So he says that these events are part of the first half of this final 7-year period leading to the end of the age, and he calls these the beginning of birth pangs for the end of the age. Fourth, the prayers of martyrs bring the promise of justice. Verse 9. And when he broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, wilt thou refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And there was given to each of them a white robe. And they were told that they should rest for a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, should be completed also. Now stop and think for a moment. Each seal is a judgment of God. That makes sense in the first four seals, because what happens is horrific to the population in this world. Those unbelievers. It makes sense in the sixth seal, which we'll look at in a little bit. But how is the fifth seal a judgment of God on earth? The death of Christian martyrs is God's judgment on earth? No. The seal is not God killing his own people. John sees the souls of the saints under the altar of, probably the altar of incense in heaven, for that was the symbol of prayers, the prayers of the saints in the ancient temple and in the Word of God. These souls crying out to God have already been slaughtered because of their testimony for God in this world. They are not being killed here as part of the fifth seal. They have already been killed during the first four seals. Now, Jesus had already predicted in Matthew 24, verse 9, that prior to the midpoint of this period, the 70th week of Daniel, the abomination of desolation, which comes at the midpoint, he said, They will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. Now, that really is the prospect of believers in any generation. But it will become even more evident during these final days as the world comes to hate anyone who professes Jesus Christ. To follow Christ. It's certainly God's call on believers in every age and every generation, but as things get worse, people are going to hate even more anyone who professes to follow Christ. And there will be people during this final period of time who will come to Christ and they will witness for Him, and we will learn later in Revelation that their witness will be heard around the world. These people will die for their faith as countless Christians have died for their faith all down through history. And they cry out for justice and Christ's vengeance on those who have killed them. What is the seal then? The seal then is the prayers of the saints that cry out for God to bring justice to this world. God hears the prayers of His people and He responds to those prayers. And God promises to honor these prayers by unleashing His vengeance upon this godless world. He just tells the saints, it will happen in due time. But I will do it. That's the seal. That's the judgment. Now, this is what we call theologically an imprecatory prayer. An imprecatory prayer, we see them a lot in the book of Psalms, for example, and other places, is crying out to God to carry out His justice and His vengeance in this world. That's rather offensive to our modern minds. Have you ever prayed for God to judge this world, to bring vengeance upon this world? We don't like that concept, do we? What do we do with this kind of prayer in our theology? Can Christians pray like this? Or should we always pray for God to forgive them? Yes, Christians can pray like this. Obviously, there are Christians here in heaven's throne room praying like this. Imprecation is an appropriate prayer as long as we realize that we have no right to carry it out. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, God says. No human has that right. That's why we forgive. But God does. And God promises essentially to carry out this vengeance, this judgment upon the earth in response to the prayers of his people. Vengeance is God's prerogative, and we give it to him to deal with in his time. That's the essence of an imprecation, and the essence of imprecatory prayer. You see, in the time of grace, we're pleading with God to save people. But when the time of judgment comes, grace is over. And there are no prayers for grace at that point, for it's judgment time. God tells the martyrs to rest. Rest, be at peace for the time being. In their robes of righteousness, he says, be at peace, rest, until all those whom Christ has determined will die for their faith has been completed. Now that's an interesting thought, isn't it? That's something we learn here about God. God knows in advance how many of his saints will die for their faith. He knows exactly who they are and how many there are. He tells the martyrs who have died for their faith unjustly in this world, he says, rest until the number is completed who are to die as you have died. And then I will judge. He will vindicate all those who have given their lives for their faith, because God is not just a God of grace, but a God of justice as well. When the time of grace runs out, the time of justice begins. Fifth, cosmic calamities warn of the coming wrath. Verse 12. And I looked when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind. And the sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up. And every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? The sixth seal is all about cosmic calamities. It's funny that the insurance industry calls to such things acts of God today, because in the end they will be. There will be a great earthquake, and the sun will become black, like the sackcloth that mourners wore made of black goat's hair. The moon will turn blood red. The stars will fall to earth. The word stars doesn't necessarily mean literally stars, but was often applied in the ancient world to what we would call meteors today. So earth will be engulfed in meteor showers as if a fig tree shook all of its figs and they came flying down to the ground. The heaven will seem to split like a scroll. You take a rolled up scroll and it rips apart in the middle and the two sides and come rolling up together. The earth and the sky will seem to split like this. The mountains and the islands will move out of their places. Talk about a terrifying situation. We have a little earthquake somewhere and it's terrifying, or a tsunami or something and it's terrifying. This is way beyond anything that we can even imagine. The people from all walks and positions of life, from the kings and government leaders, along with the wealthy down to the slaves who make up the very lowest stratas of society, they're going to run to hide in caves and in the mountains. Why would you go to the mountains? They're falling in on you. But they will plead with the rocks to fall on them and hide them. They would rather die by the rocks falling on them than face the wrath of the one who sits on the throne of heaven, or the wrath of the Lamb. Imagine people would rather die by the earthquake than face God. The unregenerate will recognize that the day of the Lord, the wrath of the Lamb, has already arrived. It is a past tense verb. The time has arrived. They know the wrath is just about to get worse as the age comes to a close, but we're already in it. These cosmic calamities are the sign of God's closing judgment on the age of men who reject Him and His truth. Horrible time. Now, all of these descriptions fit quite well with what Jesus predicted in Matthew 24. The passage is sometimes called the Little Apocalypse because of its similarity, its parallels to the book of Revelation. Christ places the events we see in the sixth seal after the abomination of desolation and just before the return of Christ in Matthew 24, verse 30. Earthquakes, cosmic convulsions will cause people to flee to the mountains, and the heavens will erupt. The sun will be darkened. The moon will turn bloody red, Jesus says. The stars will fall from the sky. And then the very next verse, he tells us the Son of Man will come on the clouds. Matthew 24, verse 30. So this immediately precedes the end of this age and the coming of Christ. So putting all of these passages together on a timeline, then we see, I think, that the fifth and sixth seals take place just before the end of this age. That's consistent with Old Testament passages about the cosmic disturbances, such as Joel chapter 2 and verse 31, where we're told that these things will take place before the coming of Christ to this earth at the end of this age. But how can that be? We have now arrived almost to the end of this age, and we're only in Revelation chapter 6. And in the book of Revelation, Christ doesn't come till chapter 19. So how can we already be there if we've got all these intervening chapters in the book of Revelation to deal with? Where do we fit the rest of the book? Well, I'll say much more of this later, but let me quickly summarize what I think is the best way to understand the sequence of Revelation. You know that there are three sets of seven judgments. They're called the seals. There's seven seals, there's seven trumpets, and then there's seven bowls. Three sets of seven judgments. Many see these as events that take place in chronological sequence. But the Hebrew style of writing, and John was a Hebrew, was to tell stories in a cyclical manner. We see this in the Old Testament. We see it in all of their literature. They would take one tour around, and then they'd come back around and take another one, expanding and adding to the information. Now, we can illustrate it, I think, by an old-fashioned telescope or spyglass. When you open up the spyglass, it's in several segments, right? But when you close it all up, it's in one segment, or at least a much smaller segment with overlapping pieces. So it is with the three sets of seven judgments, I think. These judgments are what I call telescoping judgments. John will open them up for us so that we can see them clearly, but they're actually describing the same period of time over and over again. the 70th week of Daniel, with new and expanded information each time we take a new tour. And there are interludes between each of these where John gives us other information, and then he goes back to the story again. So the seals start at the beginning of the 70th week and go all the way to the end. And the other judgments overlap them and take us back through with additional information. Well, let me tell you why I think this, and it's hardly original with me, so don't think it is. This is probably one of the most or more common viewpoints for understanding the structure of the book of Revelation. Number one, each seven culminates in victory for Christ. You can look up the passages for yourself and compare them. Number two, each seventh opens the next seven. Number three, each seven ends with cosmic calamities. And number four, cosmic calamities signify the end of the age. So each seven is coming to the end of the age. We're going to see these same cosmic calamities again in the book because they signify the time just before Christ returns and the end of the age. Now, I think we can say that these are overlapping events, but they're not identical events. Seals give more detail on the early stage. Trumpets seem to expand in the middle, and bowls seem to give more detail on the end. They are overlapping sets of information for us, all dealing with the 70th week of Daniel. So we get more details about the period as we open up the telescope. So essentially, I think John takes us on three tours of the 70th week with new and expanded information each time. All right, you chew on that for a while. We're going to come back to it as we work our way through because we're just about to take a break from it all because there's an interlude that we get a whole bunch of additional information, and then we'll go to the trumpets and we'll work our way through it each time. But you chew on it as you study and think about the book of Revelation. The question is, what are we to do with all this information? This is a horrific time, is it not? This time of judgment upon the earth. Well, folks, Christ has left us on this earth with all of this information. He gave the book of Revelation for a reason. Why do we have it? We have it because our job is to warn people about the coming judgment. We're a spiritual Ian McConnell in the helicopter. We're supposed to be out there rescuing people. That's our job. And you don't want to be against God when the time of grace comes to an end and the time of judgment begins. So as Christians, we're to warn people that there is a way out of God's judgment, and that's to believe in Jesus Christ. Put your faith in Christ. That's the way to avoid the horror that is coming upon this earth when Christ pours out his wrath on those who rebel against him. You don't want to be part of that judgment. In Phuket, Thailand, Tilly Smith, a 10-year-old girl, saved her parents and dozens of fellow vacationers from the deadly tsunami because she had studied well a school geography lesson and then spoke up about what she knew. As Tilly's family enjoyed a day at Macayo Beach, the sea began to bubble and it rushed away from the shore. While the adults walked down and they were kind of curious about this strange phenomenon, Tilly was petrified with fear. "Mummy, we must get off the beach now," she said. "I think there's going to be a tsunami." The adults didn't even understand her warning, until Tilly referred to it as a tidal wave, Mommy. Once they understood, they all believed the youngster, 10 years old, They evacuated the area. Minutes later, of course, the water surged right over the beach, demolished everything in its path. The entire resort right there was destroyed. But that section of beach was one of the few places along the shores of Phuket where no one was killed or even seriously hurt because of a 10-year-old's warning. Tilly was praised for raising the alarm. She was praised. They said she was a hero. Tilly gave credit to her geography teacher for his lesson on how earthquakes cause tsunamis. She explained, "I was on the beach and the water started to go funny. I recognized what was happening and had a feeling there was going to be a tsunami." And so she warned people. You and I know there's a judgment coming. There's no way for us not to know. We just talked about part of it. We also know that God has provided an escape. Are we warning our friends and neighbors now, before it's too late? Father, give us the courage to speak out, to share, not just your grace, that's the part that is easier to share, but also the warning. For you are a wonderful God of grace and love, but you are also a God of justice, and there's coming a day when the time of grace ends and your time of justice begins. Help us to warn our family and friends, to pray for them, to seek them, that they might come to know your grace and not have to experience your justice. In Jesus' name, amen.